Rainbow Maid has been recurrent in the history of Buddhism, in that one of the common, not, I don't know if it's common, but one of the things that you find in the history of Buddhism in Asia is periodically there'll be a Buddhist king or Buddhist ruler that would take over a country, like King Ashoka in India and kings in China, sometimes in Korea. I don't know about Japan. And they would outlaw the death penalty because of their Buddhist faith. There's a very strong streak in Buddhism in the direction of ahimsa, or nonviolence. And it takes the form not only nonviolence in terms of the avoidance of capital punishment, but also the avoidance of killing any living being. King Ashoka, who was the first Buddhist ruler in India around the year 300 BC or so, he not only outlawed the death penalty, but he also stopped all aggressive wars. He maintained a defensive army, which he probably felt like he needed to, because he had been a very vicious conqueror before he was converted. The story goes that in one of his vicious conquering of much of India, one of his battles, he walked across the battlefield after the battle had been won, with most of the soldiers dead on the battlefield, and there was this carnage of blood and limbs and death all around, people screaming, I guess, still in agony. And across that field, after the battle, there walked a Buddhist monk whose the way he carried himself, his peace, his serenity, his compassion, his something about the way he was in this very dramatic setting, caught the attention of the king, of the ruler, and converted him, changed the whole direction of his life. And he then gave up war and instituted many humanitarian projects. And he's held up as the great example in history of Buddhism of the just ruler. There's a story that maybe many of you know about. There was a man by the name of Ahimsa, which means nonviolence, who was a student, was a Brahmin in ancient India, time of the Buddha, and he was a student of a famous Brahmanical teacher. And the teacher had many students, and Ahimsa was the favored student. He excelled above everybody else. And at some point, the other students became jealous. And so they wanted to do something to fix this situation. So they told the teacher that Ahimsa had been sleeping with his wife. And the teacher was furious and then banished Ahimsa from the school and kicked him out and said, I will not accept you back until you bring me a necklace that contains fingers, 1,000 fingers of 1,000 people that you kill. This is somehow his punishment. I don't know how he, you know, what he thought about the people who were dying. So this man then went about India killing people. And he was quite ruthless and quite successful. And there were many attempts to try to capture him and stop him and kill him, but he somehow was able to overcome the various armies and whatever sent out for him. And then he acquired the name of Angulimala. And Angulimala means finger necklace, because he had this necklace of all these fingers. Quite gruesome. And he needed 1,000 fingers, and he had 999. And he was walking out in the forest where he lived, and somehow it occurred to him that his mother was an easy target. And now matricide and patricide is considered to be one of the worst possible evils in Buddhist tradition that you can do. So with his great abilities, the Buddha somehow perceived that he could, that this terrible thing was going to happen, absolutely awful thing. So the Buddha decided to intervene. And the villagers said, oh, don't go into the forest, because this Angulimala, he just doesn't stop at anything, and you can't defend yourself against him. And the Buddha just went anyway. And Angulimala was walking down through the forest, and Angulimala then saw this Buddhist monk, and he said, oh, good, this is an easy prey. These monks, you know, they can't defend themselves, and this will be really easy, and I'll finish my assignment, and I can go back to my teacher, and great. And so he started going after the Buddha. And the Buddha was walking calmly down the road. And the faster Angulimala went, at some point he was running, the further the Buddha was from him. And he was running quite fast, and still the Buddha, he couldn't gain on the Buddha, it was the opposite. And so finally Angulimala yelled out, stop! And the Buddha continued calmly walking, and he said, you stop. I stopped long ago. And this kind of turn of phrase caught Angulimala's attention enough that it somehow went into his psyche, and he understood it, I think, maybe symbolically, that the Buddha had stopped, maybe you'd say, greed or hate or violence. He had stopped the neurosis, the psychosis of his mind, all the different forces of greed, hate, and delusion. And his mind was at peace. Whereas Angulimala's mind was driven and running and furious and in pain. And so the Buddha said, you know, I've already stopped. Why don't you stop? So Angulimala then, there that very moment, gave up his ways and was ordained as a Buddhist monk. So the local king didn't know this, though. So the local king was still set on capturing this, or killing this mass murderer. So he came into the forest with a huge army of people to look for him. And in the forest, he first, at some point, he came upon the Buddha, surrounded by his monastic disciples, his monks and nuns. And since the monastics spend much of their time in the forest, he thought these are people maybe to ask if they've seen Angulimala. So he came up to the Buddha, and the Buddha was sitting there quietly and with an attendant behind him, fanning him, because it was a hot season, perhaps. And the king said, have you seen Angulimala, the great murderer? And the Buddha said something like, oh, what would you do if you saw him? Oh, I would get my army out, and we would pull out our swords, and we would surround that guy before he had a chance, and we would just do him in. And the Buddha said, and what would you do if you found out that Angulimala had renounced his ways, had become a renunciant, had entered the Buddhist order of monastics, and was seriously engaged in a life of nonviolence and a life of spiritual change, transformation? And the king said, oh, in that case, I would bow down to him and leave him alone. And the Buddha said, well, this attendant behind me who's fanning me is Angulimala. At which point the king's hair stood on end. And he goes very frightened. But he saw that this was a monk, and he had enough confidence or trust in the Buddha that if the Buddha had taken this man in to be a renunciant, it wasn't just a ploy or a trick, but this really was involved in some radical transformation. And so he left him. And by the king, at least, he was not forgiven, but at least left to live this new life. As the story goes on, Angulimala then continued his spiritual practice and attained the highest attainment of full liberation that a person could attain. And became not only a force of peace and non-violence, but also a source of compassion for the people he met, compassionate action. But one day he was out for his morning alms rounds, which the Buddhist monastics do every morning, and he happened to walk through the village, one of the villages where he had killed a lot of people, and the people recognized him, and so they threw stones on him and bruised him quite a bit. He came back to the Buddha all bruised and bloody, and And the other monks were kind of a little bit surprised, and they said to the Buddha, how could this be? He's someone who's attained full liberation, free from all suffering, and how could something like this happen to him, that he got stoned? And the Buddha said, he certainly has severed all his past evil. He's eradicated all that and uprooted it. And he's radically transformed, and he's now a force of goodwill and peace in the world. But he's not free of his past karma. The consequences, the social consequences of the action, the way people feel hurt and angry and upset and are still there. He has to still, in a sense, that's part of the field of his life. His personal transformation doesn't change those relationships automatically. And so he has to bear it. But he bears it patiently, the Buddha said. He still has to live by his karma, but since he's fully liberated, he endures it patiently, was the expression. So Angulimala is often, the story is often held up for the people who want to avoid, do away with the death penalty. And in fact, in England, there's a fairly large Buddhist group, or Buddhist in Christian terms you call it a ministry, ministering to people in prisoners. And that group in England is called Angulimala. They've adopted that name for their group. And in part, it's held up as an example of how people can be transformed and changed. That people can be, I don't know if redeemed is the right word, but they can be transformed and changed radically and completely make a complete change and switch from the way they were before, even though at times they seem to express some of the worst evil that a human being can engage in. Whether that can happen every time, I don't know. I don't know if anybody knows if everyone can be changed and transformed. There was a debate later in Indian Buddhism about whether there were such people for whom it was impossible for them to make any spiritual progress. Did such people exist at all? And there were different sides to that point of view. The people who thought there were such people called such people ichantikas. I don't know what the word means, but the definition is those who have no spiritual hope for them. But certainly there's a strong current that many people can be transformed and changed. In my kind of thinking about this today and thinking back in my training in Asia and how the teachings I got there might relate to the issue of the death penalty, I think some of my teachers would first not have considered the redemptive possibility of the killer, but would have first considered the karmic consequences of the executioner. That if you're going to have capital punishment, someone has to do the executing, and in Buddhism, it's very serious karma. It's very bad, very horrible thing for your karma, for your well-being, for your inner psychic life, to be involved in killing someone. And for someone to, I guess, in Timothy McVeigh's situation, the executioner will be a volunteer. The people involved in the prison there, mostly in America, I think nowadays it's prison personnel volunteer for these positions. But still, it's a whatever reason it's there. Even though it's condoned or prescribed by society that this action has to happen, the person who actually injects the poison is taking on a tremendous karmic debt or karmic consequence for themselves. So the Asian teachers would have been horrified by what was going to happen to the executioner. That this, you know, if the executioner knew what they were taking on, they would never get close to committing the execution. So that, I believe that's often the first thought that would come. And perhaps that's because the deed has been done, awful as it is, but they're looking at what can be done now. And one of the next things, the practical things, is, well, let's avoid this horrible thing that's going to happen next, which is the horrible karma for the executioner. Not to speak of perhaps the suffering of the person being killed. When I was in Asia also, I remember in Burma, one of the, it wasn't that often, but one of the more, because we didn't have common themes that much, but in the Dharma talks, but one of the recurrent themes we did have was my teacher liked to tell stories about people, Burmese people who came to his monastery who had horrific backgrounds, and their experience in meditation. And he would get people who came from both the army, who were, the Burmese army is pretty vicious, and kill and torturing lots of people. But also the rebel groups who are fighting the army are just as bad. And they would do a lot of killing and torturing. And sometimes both sides would, some individual from both sides would give up that life and become a monastic or come into the monastery, which was kind of a free man zone, and be engaged in spiritual practice. And he would talk about how difficult it was, the tremendous obstacles they had to face based on what they had done in the past. That those actions, that killing, created tremendous psychic blocks, psychic obstacles that they had to overcome in their meditation. And every time it was, you know, this heroic effort, they would sit through it and they would burn up and they would have these horrific visions. And sure enough, they would break through that and there would be some transformation. Perhaps there were stories he didn't tell us about people whom it didn't work, but he liked telling us situations where it worked. So it's interesting to look at an issue like capital punishment as a Buddhist practitioner, because what it entails, I think, is certainly looking at our own motivation in our relationship to it. It also entails looking at what are all the various karmic consequences, what are all the various connections to such an event, the interdependent world of such an event, because it's very easy to have a very narrow opinion, a solitary opinion, to be filled with anger, for example, at one person, and then say, well, this person needs to somehow be punished for that action. And it's all about revenge. And to be blinded by the desire for revenge or punishment and not see the tremendous field of interconnected cause and effect that that one action might have. For example, to what degree does execution in the United States, government sanctioned executions, support a culture of violence in the United States? Does it support the very culture out of which Timothy McVeigh came? Timothy McVeigh came out of a culture of guns and violence, the militia movement. And to what degree is the whatever violent aspect there is of American culture, to what degree is that supported kind of psychically by the kind of influence that public executions have? You know, maybe some people don't want to think about that, or they think obviously there's none, or whatever. But the Buddhist tendency is to try to think, what are the wider implications of what's going on? What's the wider nexus of connections going on? And not make it just a single solitary item, issue, you know, single issue, just revenge, or just punishment, or just one thing or another. I read today in a Time magazine article, they had an article about evil. And since I was thinking about this today for a talk, I read the article on evil. And the biggest surprise in reading this article for me was the claim, it was what Time magazine said, that Adolf Hitler's book Mein Kampf was, apparently to a large degree, was plagiarized from a book written by Henry Ford, who was an anti-Semitist, who wrote this apparently this anti-Semitic tract that probably was translated into German. And so you can't blame Henry Ford for what Hitler did in Germany. But to what degree is there a wider kind of culture, a wider milieu that made it a lot easier for Hitler to kind of rise to power and do what he had to do? And to what degree did what happened was happening in America also influencing eventually what happened in Germany? So the tendency in Buddhism is to look at these wider connections and not to kind of look at something in its just only in its only its you know narrow very narrow one issue kind of point of view. So what is the influence, what's the effect that capital punishment has on the wider society, And that's one of the big debates in our society, and different people fall on different sides of that. Some people are quite convinced that it works very well as a deterrent, and some people feel that it doesn't work as a deterrent at all, and both sides kind of mass together all kinds of data, and and there's conflicting data, and we don't know quite who to believe. Which side, can we arbitrate which data we're going to believe? Or at some point, do we believe our hearts? So then the question is, what is our personal relationship to an issue like capital punishment? How do we relate to it? Is it out of sight, out of mind kind of thing? Or it's only really relevant in a way that you feel like you can make a difference when it's time to have an election on such issue? And so you vote yes or no for capital punishment. But is the relationship to capital punishment one of, is it primarily influenced by a person's anger, or by their fear, or by almost kind of a pornographic kind of voyeurism, kind of this excitement, it's kind of, there's a lot of juice for some people to kind of participate or watch or know about an execution. And it wasn't so long ago in this country that there were public executions, really public. I mean, I think the last one was in 1936. It was basically a public hanging anybody could come to. And there used to be, in England and places, that they were very public, and children would be there, and all kinds of people would be there to watch. And ancient Rome, the Colosseum in Rome, people would come to watch the gladiators kill themselves. There is an element of kind of, I don't know what to call it exactly, but kind of excitement and that people get. So is the personal relationship one of kind of glee, excitement that something like this is happening? What's the personal relationship individuals have to this kind of topic? So that's, I have a lot more I can say on this topic. But the danger if I say too much is that I slide too much into my opinion, which maybe is already obvious. And so I think rather than just kind of going on with things I could talk about, I thought we can have some discussion as a group about this topic. See what your thoughts are and what your reflections have been on this topic and maybe your questions you might have. Yes?
I have a question. I actually was talking about this briefly with someone at work, and I have kind of a black and white view, which is, two rights don't make a wrong, and it's just not a good idea to kill other people. And this person said to me, they said, well, what if you have knowledge, as we somewhat do, that this person plans to kill other people if he's, allowed to stay alive? And I don't,
So if you've been in Oklahoma City just before Timothy Vivek did his job, and you had a chance to kill him before he killed 168 people,
right?
Should you have?
Yeah, or thinking about Angoulême, there wasn't much talk about those 999 people who died, and, so it's that now is a bit confusing for me. I don't believe in killing people, but what about all the people that are killed or maybe will be killed if,
So this has been a big debate in the history of Buddhism, this very issue. Is there times when it's justified to kill someone? And the only time it seems to be justified is this issue here, if you know that you're going to prevent a lot of other people from being killed. And so different Buddhists will argue this back and forth, and there's different opinions within Buddhism on this topic. One very traditional view, especially in Theravadan Buddhism, which tends to be much more literal and legalistic overall, kind of as a generalization, is no way. Should you sacrifice your own karma, because the karma is so bad on you, even if it's for a good cause, you're creating such bad karma for yourself that no one in the right mind would do something like that, because you might save the life of 168 people, but you might spend 168 billion years burning in hell. Hell in Buddhism is always temporary. So after 168 billion years, you get out. And And other people feel that other people have decided that it's not okay exactly. I don't think anybody Buddha said it's okay. How could it be okay? But some Buddhists have come to the decision that they know that's a terrible thing to do. They know they're going to create very bad karma for themselves in doing it. But out of their compassion for all the people who are going to be potentially killed, they're willing to sacrifice their own well-being. So the person who interferes, catches the murderer beforehand and kills the murderer, the mass murderer, that person's willingly taking on 168 billion years in hell. So the 168 people in this life won't die. And that's the way it's kind of, so it's a kind of an act of compassion and sacrifice of oneself in order to do that. So that's the extent that I know of that. And so you find people making that decision in the history of Buddhism. You found various times, even in the modern world, you find some monastics. I think in Burma there was a monk who either killed or tried to assassinate one of the leaders of Burma in the last 50 years. And in Sri Lanka there was something like that. And you find various times Buddhist monastics involved in murder. And they realize they're taking on bad karma, but they feel that, you know, this person has to be stopped. But that's a very hard decision to know. You know, it's kind of like playing God. Yeah.
Well, it's very chilling to me to think that somebody can kill another person thinking that perhaps they're going to be killing 168 people because there's always a chance that person may not do it.
Right. Yeah.
Of course, that's maybe a bit of faith there.
Right.
It's a person will change, but it's a terrible decision to make about somebody else.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. But I completely agree. But and then but there was at least one German in the middle of World War II who was in the inner circles of Adolf Hitler and knew what was going on, and he planted a suitcase with bomb underneath the table where Hitler was, and the bomb didn't do what it set out to do, and he, you know, he saw what Hitler was doing. It wasn't like potentially, it was like an ongoing event. So it's still kind of chilling, but you know, if you kind of, sometimes when you take these kind of ethical issues, what people like to do is to take the most extreme example. What about an extreme example? And the question is it fair to take the most extreme example, and then because of the extreme example, justify, you know, in all other circumstances, and Timothy McVeigh for some people is a really extreme case. So extreme that even a lot of people in the United States who are against the death penalty are staying pretty quiet this time, because they kind of think, well, this guy, you know, I'm against it, but I can't quite. Like I feel that in myself, actually, you know. So I was invited to this vigil, and I can't go tomorrow. But I find my, you know, if it had been the execution of almost anyone else, I would have gone with more motivation. But you know, the motivation, I find myself, my motivation a little bit wavering because of this particular one. I mean, I'm still very clear in my opinion, but I find it odd that I have little different feeling about it here. And that's one of the reasons why I think this particular time of this execution is very powerful for us as a country, as a psyche, because it is, even though we shouldn't take the exception as kind of as a place to generalize, sometimes the exception kind of opens up the heart to kind of look at the whole thing anew, breaks us out of our complacency. I'm sorry if I talk too much after.
I think there's a distinction that needs to be made between forgiveness and the view of the death penalty. That is, we're in no way obliged to condone this person if we're opposed to killing him.
Right.
And the alternative is not to let him out to go kill someone else.
Right.
I mean, sometimes when you set up an extreme case like that, you're introducing other ethical issues in addition to the one that you're trying to deal with. And extreme cases almost always do that. So while I can appreciate the issue of Timothy McVeigh himself is not a sympathetic character. It doesn't change the issue for me that we shouldn't kill him. And there was a very interesting article on the subject in the Sunday magazine of the New York Times this week. And there was a man whose wife was killed in a bombing who was very, very, very pro death penalty. And he's now come to the decision that he does not think the man should be killed. And his reason is that by focusing on it so much, he's come to realize that he did not want to become like him.
Yes. Uh-huh. Nice. Adam.
A couple months before the election, there was actually an interesting article in the New York Times, and I followed up by something in the and All Things Considered about the people who in Texas were charged with killing, you know, the most folks of any other state, and the problems that they would be having after. And so it just seemed to me to kind of point out that the ramifications of being involved in that act, you know, that people really did have a hard time with having that job. And another thing that just always perplexes me a little, there's no calculus of suffering or karma, or I wonder if there is in the Buddhist viewpoint, but it seems to me like our prisons I've never been in a prison, but my impression is that it's a very hellish place, with a lot of violence and a lot of bad karma, if you will. And I just somehow it seems to me like there's an amazing amount of bad, you know, basically bad will and so forth that might be generated out of an institution like that, into which we put a larger percentage of our population than most other countries in the free world.
Yeah. John.
Well, since we're talking about bad karma, I think that we kind of forget that war is just a justification of killing, and what kind of collective karma do we have in our country for our huge arms buildup and are selling of weapons to other countries so they can carry on wars. And I think this is very much a part of the question of justified killing.
Mm-hmm.
No answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the interesting questions, I think, is to what degree is it complicity by citizens of a country? To what degree do Americans feel like, well, that's happening in Washington D.C. It's those people who are doing it, and to what degree do we feel like we're all part of it together, the choices the government makes, and or what degree of responsibility do we feel we have? And I suspect that the low turnout, voter turnout in this country, reflects a feeling that many people have that they don't feel responsible. Yes?
Yeah, I'd like to make several points. One is, I think as far as the role of karma goes, what you do is basically positive and negative. And if someone were to, say, assassinate Saddam Hussein, who will be killing more and more people, I think it's only in your feeling that they might be taking on some heavy karma, even though they'd be saving lives. I think that's just conjecture. We don't really know. And I think, unless someone has some definite proof of that, but I think it would be a positive thing. And as far as the McVeigh situation, there's some paradoxes here, because we're all familiar with the near-death experiences and going down the tunnel and all that love and so forth. So in a way, it would be a kind thing in that sense. I remember seeing a documentary with Raymond Moody on TV, and by the time he got through and everything he was describing, I was looking forward to dying someday, which is kind of a funny situation. So there's that kind of paradox that's cruel and unusual.
If I could jump in,
yeah.
You said the first thing was a conjecture about karma.
Yeah.
It's also a conjecture what's going to happen to each of us when we die. Even though there might be some examples, anecdotes about wonderful near-death experiences, it's just conjecture what's going to happen to anyone.
Yeah, well, what my understanding is that the research that's been done is so overwhelming. And different people from all different cultures all over the world, it seems to be pretty much the same thing. There's some diversity, but it's pretty much the same thing. So anyway, the third point I wanted to make was that a lot of the clergy who are against the death penalty because it's cruel and unusual punishment, and some people will counsel people with cancer, terminal cancer patients, and talk about, you know, there's no big problem in dying and you're going to the great beyond and so forth and so on. So there's that inconsistency there. So I have a lot of questions about this.
Yeah. One of the things that I don't know very much about was how the people in Cambodia are dealing with the leaders of the Khmer Rouge that have recently been caught. From what I understand, the United States government has been putting pressure on that government to inflict greater punishment on those leaders that have been caught for doing horrendous killing. I mean, you know, this is not 168 people, it's
millions.
Millions. Is there anything about that that you...
Yeah, I really don't know much about the situation. Yeah.
Would make a little point that experience is a good teacher, and I've had the fortunate and unfortunate experience of being firsthand with this whole subject. 10 years ago, I had 3 family members that were murdered. One of the murderers happened to be my brother, and so it, as you can kind of imagine, sets up a kind of interesting dynamic. For me, this has been an issue of being somewhat new to Buddhism in the last year and a half or so. It's something I really struggle with because, on one hand, I have anger because I've really gotten past it. It's been 10 years, but my brother's still in prison, doing life without parole because I requested not having a death penalty. And it was something I really struggle with. And whenever this issue comes up, and it comes up about twice a year, somebody gets executed or something like that, I really can see both sides of the fence. I mean, if I'm sitting on a fence, I can clearly see both sides. And a lot of times it makes me angry when somebody makes statements on either side that has not gone through the experience. Mm-hmm. Because it's really, if you sit on one side, you say, I have 3 family members who were murdered. And I mean, in my job I see that, but I also saw the crime scene. And it's something that when people that have been through war, I've seen, and it's really something that will never leave me. But I also had the prospect of having my brother summarily murdered by, you know, potentially the government. And so I think that it's a really difficult thing, if you have not gone through it, to see it clearly. And of course, I wouldn't wish anybody to have to go through it just to see it clearly,
right.
But that it is a subject that requires really deep thought and
what it points out to me a little bit is that the tendency for us to use anecdotes to justify our position, and so you find people on both sides kind of saying they found relief and that the executioner of their family was, the killer of the family was killed. Other people who say, you know, that they didn't find relief and they wish it didn't happen, or they kind of forgive, and it's really hard to put ourselves in the shoes and to use the anecdote as a, you know, as a generalization is you know, disrespectful, I think. And so so may the one who hasn't sinned be the one who casts the first stone, kind of thing. But still, we have to vote. Those of us who don't have that experience, still have to make a decision. Yes, Ms. Mita.
I have an experience that is not really about intentional murder, but there was a sort of transformation of heart. I was very young, I was about 14, 13, I don't remember. When India was under political emergency, under Indira Gandhi, and she was grooming her younger son to be the next prime minister. India had no democracy until then. And this younger son of hers was actually quite brutal and very dictatorial, very clear where he was going. He had forced abortions from people, forced sterilizations in order to control population or whatever. So there was a lot of fear in the society in general about what's going to happen when he actually came into power, because he didn't seem to have any of her graces at all. And my family was politically sort of active, and so there was a lot of discussion of this issue and kind of fear and of this event. And then I remember one day I had a friend over, and we were studying, and we heard on the radio the news bulletin that he used to love flying planes, and he had taken a plane to fly and it had crashed. And my first feeling was also just of relief. Oh my God, you know, this, we don't have to worry about this person anymore. And I ran to my father and I said, did you hear what they just announced on the radio, that Sanjay Gandhi just died in America? And my father was, who used to be, you know, political acting and all that, he just had tears in his eyes. And he said, what on earth is that? What a young life. Can you imagine his family? Can you imagine his children? And I was just so stunned by that way of looking at it. And I thought he would be just absolutely delighted that, you know, the country was not going to be facing this person in power. And it has continued to make an impact on me all through my life as I was growing up, you know, from time to time. So there is such a ripple effect of good versus bad intention, not compassionate heart versus a hard heart, you know? And it has, you know, every time you take an action, you have to think about that, ripple effect. Far away, people you don't know, people down the road.
Yes, last one.
I have some information as a reply to the person who asked about the Cambodian situation. I happen to have a house guest now who is a Cambodian man who has worked for human rights organizations and the United Nations, and he just got back from a 5-month stint studying about human rights advocacy at Columbia, and I looked at his grant proposal that he's trying to get funded. And what he is hoping to do is rehabilitation not only of victims of torture and brutality, but rehabilitation of the perpetrators of Khmer Rouge, who are now allied with the government and still have the same mindset of brutality and are not heeding the new Cambodian constitution. And he is hoping or would like to teach them different ways of being. He didn't want to come tonight because he doesn't like meditating, but But I brought him a little bit anyway.
But I think it's all these kind of questions are fundamentally, from a Buddhist point of view, fundamentally very personal questions. And the personal aspect is in a sense more important than the public, though the public's a very important aspect also. But from a Buddhist practice point of view is to really go deeply into ourselves, into our hearts, and really see what motivates us, and to clarify that, and to purify it, and see if the best and purest motivations can be the source of our actions. And to never leave anyone out of our hearts. So thank you for this evening, and if any of you would like to join this, be part of this little group called the Mid-Peninsula People of Faith Against Death Penalty. There's information about that can be had. So, thank you all, and good night.